is Tursus Holdings LLC versus Bank of New York Mellon, case number 74546. There you go, Mr. Nelson.
Yes.
All right. Mr. Stern, you're also ready?
Yes.
Okay.
With me is Mr. Salomon.
Welcome.
So I think I can say officially good afternoon, Your Honor. This case relates to the real property commonly known as 9653 Magnificent Avenue. In this case, our office was substituted in after our predecessors told us that the final judgment had not been entered in the case and that the case was statistically closed. Since the case has not resulted in any final judgment, Tursus filed a new complaint. Bank of America moved to dismiss on the grounds that the 2013 order was a final order and the plaintiff's claims was barred by principles of res judicata. The district court granted the motion to dismiss and be appealed. This matter has been fully briefed since June 25th, 2019. And the defendant recently sent a notice of sale to plaintiff directly. I did not receive a copy from opposing counsel. My client brought it in, and the sale is scheduled to take place on July 2nd. We filed an application for a temporary restraining order. The district court could not hear it until July 1st. That was just not enough time. We were very concerned that it would not leave us enough time to appeal. And it probably would have gotten me in a lot of trouble with my girlfriend since that was my birthday and she was going to take me out. Leaving it to July 1st was kind of very, very difficult. And that's why we filed the emergency appeal that was granted here. We submit that the court should leave the order staying the sale in place and that the current bond is sufficient. In Hansen versus the 8th Judicial District, the court set forth four factors that it will consider in determining whether to grant the stay. The first factor is whether the object of the appeal will be defeated if the stay or injunction is denied. This case is about the property. My client paid money for the property. He filed a quiet title action to clear the title to the property. Okay. This is not a case where he wants money. It's a case where he wants the property. If the property sold, kind of, moves the whole purpose of the appeal to him. Okay. The second factor is whether Pelham will suffer irreparable harm. Kind of the same argument that, he wants the property, does not want to lose the property. I'm helping him with about three or four different cases, and he always asks me about this property because this is a particular property. There's something about this property that he likes and wants to keep this property. He's not looking for money damages here. Okay. Third factor is whether the respondent will suffer any irreparable harm or serious injury. We suggest that they will not. They have, if the court were to enter an injunction for continue to stay for a few months, the defendants would simply be in a position of waiting to have to sell the property. Okay. If the property value goes down, that's not irreparable harm. That's money damages to them, and we have posted a bond that will, hopefully mitigate against that. Okay. On the other hand, the property value could go up, and then they have no damage. Okay. So when you weigh the outcome, it certainly is more damaging, irreparable harm to my client. To them, it's a matter of how much money they may lose or maybe even gain.
But how do you get to proceed when the judge in the 2013 case has already ruled on Bank of New York Mellon's motion to dismiss? Isn't this the same? It's the same claim.
It's exactly
that the
same
district
claim.
Court
exactly
in
yes.
2015, But it's the
same.
Right. Judge Leavitt looked at what happened in 2013 and said, oh, this has already been ruled on.
Right.
So I'm going to dismiss it based on that.
Right. But that's based on res judicata. Okay. And res judicata only applies to a final judgment. Okay. And there was no final judgment in this case. Okay. And I went back, and if you look at the register of actions in this case, there's only one order, one disposition on the record. Okay. If this were a judgment on the, a ruling on the final judgment, there would be another disposition here.
I know you're talking about the questions surrounding the stay, but I think your time would be better focused on that, on the argument about the preclusive effect, if any, of the 2013 case status.
Sure.
And that's why this case is being argued, frankly, for counsel's benefit.
Okay.
Here, just to get to it, it appears as though the 54B certification was problematic. The case was closed administratively, and it doesn't appear that there was a final judgment. So your argument on appeal is that Judge Leavitt's dismissal of this subsequently filed case is erroneous.
Correct.
Because there was no final judgment.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. And I'm sorry, I wasn't sure whether we were
that's okay.
arguing the motion or the
let's
stay.
Let's skip to the merits here.
Thank you for directing me in that way.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, we've looked at it, and again, there's no, I don't think there's any facts that are in dispute here. Everybody can see what the facts were.
Mm-hmm.
And the bottom line is there's just not there was no final judgment entered. And that's a requisite. And if you, and I did pull the minutes from when the case was dismissed. It was a status check on the motion for summary judgment. Counsel for the defendants appeared. Counsel for the plaintiff did not appear. Okay. And the plaintiff, counsel for the defendant said that they had not been in contact with counsel for the plaintiff. Okay. And the court then said on the record that it had contacted plaintiff's counsel, and the plaintiff's counsel thought that the case was over, and it was okay with him that the case got dismissed. That's in a minute order. Right? We don't have plaintiff's counsel on the record saying that.
But did the court then proceed to dismiss the case based on those representations?
Yes, it did. But there were, it dismissed, but it didn't.
Dismissed or administratively closed?
Well, it ended up, the minutes say that the court.
Forget the minutes.
Okay.
The minutes are not in order.
Okay.
This court repeatedly has said in case after case, we don't operate on court minutes, we operate on orders. Is there an order in the district court in the 2013 action following that exchange that resulted in a final judgment?
No.
All right.
No. And I was.
But in February of 2014, didn't Judge Barker enter a summary order dismissing as to Boney, B-O-N-Y, the 2013 case, order that it be certified as final under 54, and said it was granting Bank of New York's motion in its entirety?
It granted Bank of New York's motion in the entirety, but the 54B certification was not proper. Okay, and there was not, the rule says that there's certain specific findings that have to be made, and none of those findings were made, and there's actually, there is no, if you look at the docket, there is no 54B certification order on the docket.
So your argument is that there's two defects associated with 54B, the absence of a order certifying it, and then secondly, the fact that even if it had been, it failed to meet the 54B requirements because there's still another party in the action.
Correct.
Okay, I think we understand your argument. Is there anything else you'd like to offer at this time?
Nope, that's it.
All right, you have 6:20 left. Mr. Stern?
Good Good afternoon. Ariel Stern on behalf of Bank of New York Mellon. The 2013 case did result in a final judgment in the manner that finality should be interpreted and applied for purposes of claim preclusion. I think the argument that the appellant makes here is that finality with respect to appeal, as we determine whether an appellate court has appellate jurisdiction, is coextensive with and synonymous with finality for claim preclusion. We argue that it is not. Under the correct understanding of finality as the court should apply in claim preclusion analysis, this was a final order entitled to preclusive effect, and so the district court's order of dismissal was correct. I think, are in agreement that the 54B certification was problematic in that it did not have the factual findings and conclusions that the rule requires. It was not problematic in the sense that it would have been incorrect to certify as a final judgment under Rule 54B. It was an error in the drafting of the order. The minutes don't reflect this in the record, but we've gone a little bit beyond the record already in discussing minutes. I would point out that it was actually the plaintiff that had asked for the 54B certification. Be that all as it may, Rule 54B certification deals with appealability, with whether an action vests an appellate court with jurisdiction. Jurisdiction is, by its nature, an inflexible concept. It requires hard and fast rules. Equity, on the other hand, is what governs the claim conclusion analysis. Equity that allows the district court to consider all of the factors.
Isn't claim preclusion, under our jurisprudence, confined to the factors enunciated in Five Star?
Yes, Justice Hardesty, and under those factors, there is a requirement for a valid judgment on the merits that is final. We agree with that. Five Star does not go a step further and say that that judgment must be appealable. It does not analyze or equate finality for purposes of determining whether it's an appealable judgment with whether it's final for claim preclusion analysis. We ask in this case for the court to adopt the analysis that the Seventh Circuit did in the Bell case and hold that they are not synonymous. And there is support not only in the Bell case from the Seventh Circuit, but from the Wright and Miller treatise explaining why there is divergence in the concept of finality depending on whether we're talking about appealability or claim preclusion. And I think, as the five-star analysis made very clear, equity is the source of claim preclusion. With claim preclusion, what we're trying to prevent is the serial relitigation of claims that have already been litigated and to give repose to the courts and to the litigants. That's not quite what we're looking at when we determine, or when the courts determine, whether an order is final for purposes of conferring appellate jurisdiction. There you have the concerns that a court may review things in a serial piecemeal manner and create inconsistent outcomes if the parties in the case below are still active. And so the genesis of finality for purposes of appellate review is very different from finality, what we're worried about really, when we're looking at claim preclusion. And with claim preclusion, the flexible approach that we ask this court to adopt based on the Bell decision from the Seventh Circuit is one that looks at the totality of the circumstances to determine two things. One, whether there was a judgment on the merits. I think there is agreement in this case that the judgment was on the merits, the dismissal was on the merits. Know that it was, as it turns out, incorrect, but we're not looking at that in the preclusion analysis. The other is whether it was finality, with finality, and finality under the more flexible analysis that we asked the court to adopt really looks at whether there was intent on the part of the parties and of the court to effectuate finality and whether there was a meaningful opportunity for review. And the words specifically that the Bell case, and this is just for our record, Bell versus Taylor, Seventh Circuit uses, is as a practical matter, whether there was a meaningful opportunity for review. And this is why we emphasize that this is different than the jurisdictional analysis that looks with much less flexibility as to whether the standards under Rule 54B and NREF 3A were met.
And I'm glad you focused on this point, because here's my concern. Even if this panel was inclined to consider the Seventh Circuit case and that analysis, I'm not sure that in Nevada, under our rules of appellate procedure, meaningful opportunity for review would exist. This case, had 54B been presented to the Supreme Court, the defect would have been noticed. I mean, we routinely reject defective 54B certifications that are not consistent with the requirements of the rule. And moreover, given the status of this record, a notice of appeal would have been rejected as well. So how do you address that in the context of meaningful appellate review or meaningful review?
I address it in two ways, Justice Sargent. The slight amendment you made to your question at the end there. The slight change you made in the way you phrased your question there, I think, goes to the first issue that I'd like to address. Are we talking about appellate review or review? I think in the Bell v. Taylor case with the Seventh Circuit, they made very clear that there are multiple avenues that a litigant can seek review through, and appellate review is one, but not the only one. And the specific time sequence of this case, I think, illustrates that point. This order was entered in February of 2014. Nothing happens in the case. And very timely, in September of 2014, this court issued this SFR Investments 1. And from that point forward until the status check that was mentioned in the opening argument, another 3 months go by during which, because of the defect in the 54B certification, even without it, because there had been no dismissal of HSBC at that point, there had been a default but no dismissal, at that point, the plaintiff could have sought reconsideration directly from the district court. And that would have been, in the flexible analysis that we asked this court to adopt, a meaningful opportunity for review. There was, at that point, binding authority from this court. It would have been a very straightforward Rule 60 motion based on good cause, based on that new law. So that's one instance of meaningful opportunity for review. But we would go a step further, Justice Hardesty, and point out that with respect to the defective 54B certification, the plaintiff had the option to seek an appeal to basically adopt a best practices and the inherent review that you mentioned about either the clerks or the court itself reviewing for jurisdiction and issuing an order to show cause so that we could address the jurisdictional issues probably would have been entered, and we would have fixed the 54B certification issue at that time. And so we think that when you combine that with the failure to prosecute that led to the status check and the dismissal in December of 2014, you combine all of those factors, and we see that what we really had here is a meaningful opportunity by the plaintiff to do something, whether we call it appellate review, whether we call it a motion for reconsideration, or maybe some other option. There were things that they could have done, and they didn't do. Now, technically and correctly, as a jurisdictional matter, none of that confers appealability. None of that would allow them to then come into this court and seek appellate review. But our argument is that that's a separate analysis than questioning whether in equity, which claim preclusion is, this is finality. And it is finality. At that point, by the end of December of 2014, after the lapse of several months, even after the original SFR Investments won, there's a status check in December, and as was pointed out in the opening argument, the plaintiff did not appear, consented to dismissal. And we understand that minutes are not orders, but if we look at the dismissal order, what we characterize as the dismissal order, it is a form order that indicates a statistical closing, but it gives a reason. The reason it gives is dismissal.
But that is not an order. It's in the minutes, right?
The minutes, there was an order stated on minutes in open court that then our position is in December, that's December 4th, December, I think, 29th, approximately 3.5 weeks later, there is a statistical order to close. That order, that document is an order. It's an order directing the closure of the case. And the rationale, it's not analytical. There's several boxes, one of which is checked. We concede that, but the box that is checked is dismissal. And so our decision here is we don't even need to get to that because by that point with the 54B certification attempt, and call it as it was or ineffective as it was, there was already a signal that it was intended as a final determination of the claims between the parties that are relevant. Past that point, after the December 29th determination, after that order, there was no question that that case was over. And I think if we take the plaintiffs and understanding to its logical conclusion, that would suggest that they could appeal this today, that they could go back to the 2013 case and seek that statistical closure to be perfected in some manner with a more analytical order, even if it's only a sentence or two, and then we would be here with an appealable order. And we don't think that's correct either. It's been several years. And so perhaps there's a gap in the process in the district court's issuing statistical closure orders, and maybe that's what we've encountered here, and I don't know that the court needs to address whether appealability could be perfected so long after the fact, but for purposes of claim preclusion, I think it illustrates precisely why we need a more relaxed standard for assessing finality. These are serious, potentially determinative questions when we're looking at jurisdiction, and we could have...
So I just want to be clear that what you're asking us to do is to clarify or modify the terms, the final judgment is valid in Five Star. An en banc decision of this court in 2008 that has been used repeatedly since then to make the basis for claim preclusion decisions.
Yes, Justice Hardesty, and we would, in that clarification, because we don't think it would be a change in the law, we would ask the court to include as part of its analysis that finality is something that's assumed, perhaps, to be roughly coextensive with appealability, but that issue was not present in Five Star. To our knowledge, there's really no groundswell of stare decisis type issues where we're asking you to change a rule of law that a lot of people, a lot of practitioners have been relying on. If the court issues the clarification that we suggest based on Bell versus Taylor from the Seventh Circuit, it would simply extend the understanding to reflect that finality has to be determined equitably based on the intent of the parties and whether they had a meaningful opportunity to change the status quo, which can include appealability either under finality traditionally understood or as understood by 54B, or it could include something else, such as the opportunity foregone, as it was in this case, to seek timely review from the district court when there's a change in the law. So we emphasize that the opinion that we seek here would not constitute a departure from Five Star. It would not constitute...
Since Bell, has there been any other Seventh Circuit decisions which have addressed the meaning of the phrase meaningful review?
I'm not aware of one, Justice Hardesty. I will point out that Bell is the 2016 case.
Yeah, are you aware of any other, any federal district court cases around the country that have seized on that language?
No. I will point out that, however, that Bell borrowed that concept from a Second Circuit case from 1961.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a radically new concept. And I would also... sensing that you have concerns about a significant departure, which we argue would not be a significant departure, I would also point out, for the court's reference, the Wright and Miller treatise at section 4432, which addresses the emerging trend. And I would like to, in my remaining seconds here, if it's okay with the court, read part of that. And here's Wright and Miller. A finality that was not directly disturbed by the party should not be defeated by the mere fact that an appeal might have been rejected by an appellate court jealous of its own efficient opportunity to review an entire case at once. And that comment, I think, is made in the context of whether finality for purposes of appellate review should be the same as finality with respect to claim preclusion. And there is an entire section of Wright and Miller that addresses that very question and identifies that the modern trend is the relaxed or flexible standard adopted in Bell, and that we ask the court to adopt that.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Stern. As always, we appreciate your arguments. Mr. Nelson, you have 6 minutes if you have anything more to add.
From a policy standpoint, and as somebody who's practicing and trying to figure out how to move forward with these cases, I think the plaintiff has, defendant has opened up a, if we determine on a case-by-case basis whether finality is final for appeal or final for collateral estoppel purposes, we're going to have a lot more litigation and decisions that are made on a case-by-case basis as opposed to the rule that's been in place and effective for some time that the judgment has to be final. And looking through, we did address the Bell case in our opposition, and we went, we hit right on the same point that there was no opportunity for us to review this, to bring this case for appeal at any time. If we had appealed the statistical, if we had appealed from the 1983 case, I'm sorry, from the 2013 case, it would have been rejected because there was no final order.
Well, there was one thing that, I realize you weren't counsel, but there was one thing that could have been done, and that was for the plaintiff to request a final judgment. But that didn't happen.
Right, and it appears to me, and again, we can't rely on the minutes, but,
Frankly, that 2013 case is probably subject to dismissal under Rule 41E. But nobody's filed that motion either.
Right.
All right. No. Anything else, Mr. Nelson? I'm not trying to cut you off.
No, I know.
You have ample time available if there's anything else. But your point is that adopting the Bell approach would really water down the final judgment determination and require future courts to conduct evidentiary hearings on whether a judge is final or not final for preclusive effect.
Correct.
All right. I think we understand.